you set out to try and ruin my mum's birthday or whatever it is. There isn't a like bone in my body that would try to ruin anything for anybody like this. It's so far from my DNA. And to sort of hear that not only has that happened, which I'm like mortified about, but that people think I'm trying to do it deliberately, or that I've like constructed a company that shouldn't exist. It's just so different to both my own personal DNA and to what I'm trying to achieve as a business.
Before we crack on, I want to mention a podcast I'm really enjoying called On the Edge with Andrew Gold. Andrew is an award-winning BBC journalist, bringing some of the world's most inspiring people to you in his weekly podcast. Each week is a surprise, with such guests as the Coffin Confessor, a former PI who set up a lucrative business revealing the secrets of the dead at funerals, or Baptist pastor Nicole Mitchell, who made millions as an OnlyFans stripper and life coach, and lawyer Justin Brooks, who gets innocent people off death row. You'll also get life and work advice from the likes of Intelligence Trap writer David Robson and How to Live Your Best Life author Stuart Varamund. On the Edge with Andrew Gold has been an Apple New and Noteworthy a few times, and I think it's an invaluable podcast if you're looking to better yourself, so check it out now. I'm Dan Murray-Serta, and you're listening to Secret Leaders from Infamous Media. This is the UK startup podcast where we talk with top entrepreneurs to give you insights to help you succeed and some great stories you just won't hear anywhere else. Today, I'm speaking to Aaron Gelbard, the co-founder and CEO of Bloom & Wild, a flower company that pioneered delivering bouquets directly through your letterbox. They're a household name and on a steep growth trajectory. But before we get into that, we want to know about the scrappy early days. Now, Aaron started the company back in 2013 with co-founder Ben Stanway. He chose flowers in part because it's a product that creates immediate customer feedback, so he could test as he was going, even if those first customers were just friends and family.
We used to have this pretty uninspiring office to begin with, which is what we could afford. And Ben and I used to both get an email every time we got an order. We sort of look at each other, if the order was from somebody that we didn't know, to sort of like check whether the other person, you know, we didn't even need to say anything. We sort of both knew why we were looking at each other. And then I remember there was a lady called Lisa. I won't say her last name because of GDPR purposes, but Lisa hopefully is not sort of too PII. And she was the first person that neither Ben nor I knew. And we were completely bewildered that, you know, that a person we didn't know had ordered from our company. And we immediately sort of started Googling Lisa and finding out where she worked and finding out which of our friends she could possibly know, because there's no other way that anybody could have found out about our company. And sure enough, she was a colleague of one of my friends. And so it began, but a lot of it was word of mouth. You know, I wish we had some magic growth hack that we thought of to start with. The only thing we thought of, which was like completely unscalable and wasn't a growth hack at all, but kind of worked, was we used to stand in public places and offer people a free flower in return for their email address, and then add them to our email database and stay in touch with them. And you know, we'd wear branded Bloom & Wild t-shirts, so probably there was some benefit even with people that didn't take the free flower. And we tried to be clever about where we would do this. And so one day we had the bright idea of standing in front of Whole Foods in High Street, Kent, because we thought that the demographic of people going in and out of the store would be a good demographic to target. Anyway, after about 5 minutes, the manager of the store came out and told us that he was going to call the police unless we moved, because there was some reason why we weren't allowed to be there or whatever. So we literally, without thinking, just sort of moved down to like, you know, a block away from like his front door in front of High Street, Kent tube station. And what we didn't realize is that this was basically around the corner from the office of the Daily Mail, which was not like a sort of like deliberate targeting strategy, but literally the first person I offered a free flower to turned out to be a journalist that was writing for the Daily Mail. And then she asked me what I was doing, and then she wrote an article about us. And that was like, you know, some early fame. And so, you know, I wish it was as well thought through as it turned out, but that started to help.
God bless Whole Foods.
Exactly, yeah. They didn't realize how helpful they'd been making me move on.
Okay, so basically a bunch of random stuff. So you're just like constantly throwing stuff at the wall, hoping that something sticks. Would you say, like, there's obviously a lot that's written about, you know, your first 1,000 customers or your first 1,000 true fans. So,
this strategy, getting on the Daily Mail, did you get to 1,000 customers through that, or was there still like a considerable amount more hustle?
No. I remember it was, I think we got like three orders instead of one order on the day that the article came out. And I was devastated because I, you know, at the time I didn't really understand the difference between like brand awareness and direct response marketing. And I was, I thought it was terrible. If we could be in the Daily Mail, which had, you know, millions of readers and only three people were going to order, then we were doomed. But then actually, you know, for months people told me that they'd, I told them what I was saying. They're like, oh, I read about Blumenwald in the Daily Mail. And I thought, well, why haven't you ordered yet? And then it turned out that they, you know, didn't have anybody to send flowers to, but they'd still heard about it. And, you know, we sort of were moving up in the world. I don't know how we got to our first 1,000 orders, but I know, I remember that our first Mother's Day came round. So we started the business in the summer and Mother's Day was the following March. We got 1,000 orders in the week of Mother's Day. And I remember this because I had to process them all individually in a spreadsheet, and it took me all day to do, whereas normally the order processing, you know, the week before it's taken an hour or something like that. But obviously, you know, there are just so many more to do, and I had to check that, you know, I'd imported all of the addresses right and things like this. And actually a lot of those early orders came from listing on Not on the High Street, a business I've got to know well, and it's great to see them sort of exiting in the last few days. And that was a really valuable channel partnership to start with. And it felt like a place where, for us to sell our product to exactly the right sort of consumer and demographic base. And I think from that, we learned about the value of partnerships. And obviously, the sorts of partnerships that we've been able to do have scaled over the years with our own scale. We've become interesting for businesses that are bigger and bigger. But that was the first, like, really significant one.
Now, one of the things you talked about in like the start of the conversation was about you could really work in any industry so long as you kind of had that validation, right? The fact that people really are falling in love with what you do. So you've gone into an industry where obviously that happens a lot, but usually the thanks, the love, the appreciation goes back to the recipient, not back to the company. So I don't know if I positioned the question well enough, but I see that as quite a cerebral challenge that you will have enjoyed tackling.
Yeah, we obsessed over this. So we very rapidly realized that it was going to be really important to get good customer reviews and build trust, because this is people need to trust you in order to let you be the sort of conveyor of their emotions. And so we focused on getting good review scores. And, you know, if we ever got a bad review, I'd sort of call the person up personally and understand why. And we did this for the first couple of years. I did a lot of our customer delight myself. You know, then we started tracking Net Promoter Score. And then there came a time where we thought, you know, we're tracking sender Net Promoter Score, but should we be tracking recipient Net Promoter Score as well? Because you can't systematically ask recipients to leave reviews. Obviously, anyone could go on Trustpilot or Google Reviews and write whatever they want. So you sort of get them organically to a certain extent, but we thought we should be asking as well. And so the problem is you don't have the recipient's email address. It's not very easy to ask them. But then we started putting a card in the box requesting feedback from recipients. And for the last, I think, 5 or 6 years, we've been tracking recipient NPS alongside sender NPS. And that's been really valuable because we both understand what recipients care about, which is slightly different to what senders care about. They don't care about how easy it is to order online. They care much more about condition on arrival. We also understand where there is a delta between sender and recipient NPS and what the cause of that delta is. And often it's the condition on arrival of a particular type of flower. And from that, we've evolved our range. We've also evolved our messaging. We do a lot of inbox education around bud to bloom and why we deliberately send flowers that are relatively in bud and how they bloom over time and managing recipient expectations. And that's been really important. And we've seen recipient NPS really grow over that, because rather than people assuming that we sent them flowers that aren't in good condition, they realize that we sent them flowers that are so fresh that they aren't fully bloomed yet. And over time, that's become appreciated. And I think now as letterbox flowers have become more of a mainstream phenomenon, that's also, there's been a shift in consumer expectation and people now expect and appreciate flowers coming in this format. And that's helped recipient NPS grow further.
It's interesting, I guess, you know, the same time as your company's been growing, there has been an increased interest as well, fortunately, in sustainability too. So has that had a positive impact, have you found, on like customer expectation matching, you know, the kind of values that you want to have as a company as well?
100%. So, and I think there's been in parallel, there's been an increased interest in and embracing of sustainability by our business. And you know, we issued our first Blumenwald sustainability report last summer. We're now fully carbon neutral as a business. We send zero waste to landfill. And so we've worked really hard to be a business that does things sustainably, that, you know, and many more things. Those are some, you know, some of our highlights. I think some of the underlying business model decisions that we took in the early days have positioned us well for this. So fundamentally, our boxes are smaller than boxes of other flower companies because they need to fit through a letterbox. So we're using less cardboard. We're using less space in delivery vans than people sending flowers in bigger boxes. Because we have a subscription proposition, we have the ability to choose what people get rather than them choosing what they get for some of our deliveries. It's not a very high percentage, but it's enough to give us a buffer to balance supply and demand of forecasting at the individual product level while making sure that subscribers get variety. And that's meant that our waste is virtually zero. Sourcing flowers direct from growers has also meant that waste is much lower than if you pass through middlemen who'll misforecast and damage flowers in handling. So a number of the decisions that we've taken over the years have resulted in us building a more sustainable flower company. And as we've more proactively embraced this over the last couple of years, it's meant that it's been we've been in a strong position to really be on the front foot and you know, communicate these goals and make further commitments to, you know, reduce carbon footprint in addition to just you know, offsetting carbon and things like that.
So I remember talking to you a few years ago about what your biggest challenges were, and I'm wondering if they still are the same. So obviously, you know, it might sound very hard and tricky sourcing fresh flowers, sending them across Europe now, doing it in the right kind of order management system and right time so people get good quality products, etc. But I always remember you going on and on and on about your website. I don't know if this is still a pain point for you or you remember these pains, but I guess this is my loaded question to say, was that the biggest challenge that you've had in your journey? And if so, it'd be fascinating for listeners to understand why.
I think it was probably the biggest mistake that we made. So when Ben and I started the business, you asked if we built a model. We did build a model, and there was a line item which said build website, and the budget for that was £3,000, which is what we thought it was going to cost.
Sounds spot on, mate. Yeah.
Yeah. That was in like the first month, which was how long it was going to take. And then the budget was zero in all of the other columns after that because we were going to finish it. So we obviously had no idea. And but basically, we said we're paying for this with our own savings, and you know, we didn't have that much saved up, and we couldn't afford to spend more. So we set out trying to find somebody who'd build us a website for £3,000. And you know, you can find somebody who'll do anything for you at any price, but in a way, you get what you pay for. And we got a website for £3,000, and to a certain extent, it worked. People were able to place orders. I remember we got 7 orders in our first week, and so. So that worked well, but it didn't work in all sorts of ways. It didn't work on a mobile. It said accepted Visa and MasterCard, but it actually didn't accept MasterCard, but we didn't realize this, you know, all sorts of things like that. And basically we went through various sets of developers inheriting the code from this website. But we remained very cost conscious. And because of that, it wasn't particularly good. And I think, you know, once we raised our second more meaningful sum of seed funding, we felt that we basically needed to get our tech under control. And we met somebody who started out being our tech advisor. He's now on our board. He's been on our board for many years. His name's Jackson Hull. So shout out to him. He's now the CTO at Oak North. He was CTO at One Fine Stay at the time, and he's moved through a number of companies since then. And he's been a brilliant advisor and board member to our business. And he basically gave me some tough love and told me I needed to start again. And he'd help me, if I found some developers, he'd interview them for me and make sure that we'd get people who knew what we were doing. So we did that and we started again. And we hired our first two full-time in-house developers about a year after we started. And we worked on our own website and we launched it. I remember I stayed up all night with the two of them, helping them, QA it while they were sort of working on it in the office. And then we were all sort of asleep on the office sofas in the morning when everybody else came in, and one of the guys who's still with us brought in donuts. It was super hard work, but it was like a memorable high getting this thing launched. And actually, the many things have changed since then, but the platform that these two guys built and released back in October 2014 when it launched is still the platform that we're building on today. And like, full credit to them for building something that was extensible and robust and all of the things that we didn't think about to start with. But it was a complete false economy, and it probably cost us over a year in progress and also credibility from customers, from investors, that we knew what we were doing. And so I think in hindsight, we were too cheap. Obviously, not only did we not spend enough, but actually it was value destructive rather than just a time delay to have done so.
Join us after this break to learn how to develop a physical product line, as well as Aaron's plans for European domination. Ever wonder how the e-commerce brands you admire know just the right messages to send to the right people at the right time? Guess what? It's not experience. They have the right data and the right tools. They have Klaviyo. Klaviyo helps brands easily create personalized multi-channel marketing campaigns using your most powerful asset, your customer data. Klaviyo integrates with all leading e-commerce platforms, helping you use your customer data in real time to send more relevant email and SMS automations. Klaviyo's data-driven marketing platform is sophisticated enough to power those legendary campaigns from the brands you admire, but they made it simple, easy, and fast enough for anyone to use. Building a marketing campaign is drag and drop easy. To get started with a free trial of Klaviyo, visit klaviyo.com/secretleaders. That's klaviyo.com/secretleaders. Of the six UK unicorns who have exited, can you guess what they all have in common? They've all been advised by our latest partner, Deloitte. And there's good reason for that. I know the joy and pain that comes with scaling a company fast. You need to focus on growth, your team, and customers, but often your attention is taken away by must-dos in areas like finance and compliance. I'm talking about headaches, like making sure you're charging VAT correctly on a new product, or your intellectual property is watertight, or having the right corporate structure for international expansion. These are complicated areas that you're really not trying to innovate in. So you need a partner like Deloitte who knows them inside out so you don't screw them up and you get more time and increase your chances of success. So whether you're an early stage startup or an international scale up, check out Deloitte's high growth team to help find the right answers faster. Search Deloitte Private to find out more.
I want to go back into, like you mentioned just earlier as well, flowers and gifts, and adding a whole extra word on has, shifted the focus of the business for the first time in a long time. How do you actually approach testing new products? I mean, given that your products high quality, there's a lot of effort involved, and then there's your desire to delight everyone all the time. I'm guessing you can't be that scrappy like a normal startup is with those kind of constraints. So how does the Bloom and Wild like process school of thought go through this idea?
We can be relatively scrappy. I mean, there's a bit of a lead time because you need to, it depends. Within flowers, like the lead time can be relatively quick to sort of try out different types of flowers, and there's a constant process of test, we call it vase life testing, and transit testing of different flower types to make sure that we can they'll work, and what works in combination with what else. So we're doing that all the time. Actually, with other product types, we've been able to be relatively rapid with our experimentation. The area where we've done the most has been letterbox plants. So the first letterbox plant was a letterbox orchid, which came with a soft canvas pot and a separate root ball connected, and then additional soil to put into the pot. And we still sell that product. It's not a hero product, but it was our first step into plants. And I guess the really successful product in the plant space has been mini letterbox Christmas trees, which people get super excited about every winter, and they're a really important aspect of what we do, and our customers love them, and that we build magic around them every year. And
my mum still has hers up, Also, my favorite thing about your letterbox Christmas tree is you can plant them, right?
Yeah.
They turn into real trees. She's very excited. It's growing quite slowly, I've got to say. I'm not sure it's going to be a real size tree by next year, but she's definitely excited.
No, they grow. I've got some friends who send me a picture of it every year. I've got two or three friends who do this. And they've some of them are, you know, they watch them grow alongside their children and, you know, they give them a run for their money. So give them a chance. You can replant them. And actually, I think some of the innovation has also been around stuff like that. So, you know, starting to give people instructions how to replant their Christmas trees. This year we sold Christmas trees without decorations for people who might have kept their decorations from last year. And we only sold them to people who bought our Christmas trees in the past. So we're trying to think about the sort of like sustainability impact. The other thing that we've done in this area that I think is really cool is we have started selling tulips with their bulbs on, and then you can replant the bulbs as well and people can grow tulips in the future. So I think sometimes the innovation isn't, hey, should we start selling this new thing? Often the new thing isn't actually that inspiring. I remember once we wanted to have like a gift box. So we did a box with like, I think I had a pair of socks, a pack of coffee and a notebook in it. And it just didn't feel particularly sort of interesting or differentiated. So I'm less into that type of innovation. But I think often innovation around your core product and making it feel more differentiated and more appealing to your customers is really important.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. But, you know, we're talking about, that's a lot of innovation in the flower space. And without sounding super obvious, you know, you're not inventing new flowers, you're picking the right products for your customers. And then you're thinking really intelligently about how to package them so that they can serve the right purpose, encourage people to do the sustainability side, etc. So I think the innovation comes in like the life cycle and the customer delight. I'm super curious now how you pick gifts. What is and isn't good enough? And how do you go about testing this stuff? Or, yeah, where are you in that thinking? And what is the process? Again, for someone who understandably, you know, is extremely brand conscious and anything can be a gift. So curation is really where this is at. So take us through that process.
Of course. So look, we're at the very early stages of this, but over 90% of our orders are gifts in flowers. It's marginally lower in plants, but we're still, you know, primarily a gifting company, even in the plant space. And so I guess we need to strike a balance between selling other things that people will want to buy as gifts. People's mission for shopping with us is, you know, heavily a gifting mission, but also selling things that people think are like related to our brand. 1-800-Flowers, which is currently the world's largest flower company, have gone too far on this. And if you look at the sort of top navigation on their homepage, one of the things you can buy is barbecued meats. We're not good, you asked me meat or plants, which is actually more pertinent than maybe you realise. But we're not going to start selling meats to our customers because it's just completely incongruous with what they expect from a flower company. So we need to find our position on that spectrum. We're able to test stuff with add-ons. We found that people like edible things and people like things that smell nice or smell floral. And so while we haven't decided what we're, you know, what's like next on the product roadmap, so to speak, we will continue to experiment with naturally adjacent products like this.
Got it. And from a innovation point of view, do you see yourself creating your own things? Is that kind of where you're going, or is it curating like other expert products in general?
It could be either or both, and I guess it depends on the category. And this is a bit of a sort of, we haven't figured it out yet, so this is a bit of a sort of like planning answer rather than like eureka. Sure. Answer, but feels like the more core it is to our skill set, the more likely we are to try and create it ourselves. So we've recently, this is a bit obvious, gone into dried flowers, for example, where we feel like we're well placed to come up with great dried flower propositions because the skill set is relatively similar. I can't imagine, this isn't like Blumenwald is planning to launch chocolates, but if we did, and it's not a like incongruous thing to consider, we wouldn't, I'd imagine like, build a chocolate factory and start like you know, I guess it depends how close it is to our current capabilities and like what consumers would perceive as you know, us having the authority to do.
Makes sense. Okay, so You've recently raised £75 million in a phenomenal fundraising round, which, you know, massive congrats to you, because I, like I said, I've known you since you started the business, and every round has been so purposeful, so well thought through, well, like, well timed, as in good space between every round, I've always found as well. And then this one, just a whopping round, you know, over $100 million for international expansion. So what does international expansion mean? Where have you got your sights set, and where have you got international expansion wrong so far? And what have you learned from that as well? And he's smiling because he knows this is a loaded question because we've spoken about it before.
Of course, also it's a series of connected questions. So our focus with this round is to build the leading flower and related gifting platform across Europe. We don't rule out expanding beyond Europe in the future, but the purpose of this money is to really look at the European flower landscape and build a proposition of a similar scale and quality of proposition in other countries in Europe as we've done in the UK. And we'd raised up before this point about £25 million in order to get to market leadership in the UK. And obviously this isn't how we do the maths, but roughly speaking, the UK market, we also hadn't spent all of that, but the UK market is a little under a quarter of the European flower market. So there's more complexity to how we thought about the amount than that. But I think it's the order of magnitude we'll need to rapidly build something comparable across Europe. And we've started this already, so it's not that we raised the money and then sort of like looked at a map. So we've been in Germany and France for 3.5 years now. And actually, we've had quite different fortunes in the two. In Germany, our business is on a really strong trajectory. Obviously, it's smaller than in the UK because it started later. But the growth trajectory actually is even better than it was in the UK in terms of our market share. And we're really confident in our ability to continue to scale the business in Germany. In France, we found it much more challenging. I think we've made decisions that have turned out not to be the right ones. In particular, we've based our logistics far from Paris, which is like the sort of central logistical point for most French logistical networks. And this has resulted sometimes in us having worse delivery success rate, and therefore flowers can be not only delayed, but also therefore in less good condition when they arrive, and therefore we see worse net promoter score, etc. But I think probably the bigger thing is that it's been difficult to really describe what the Bloom and Wild brand as a, you know, quite clearly British brand stands for in France, whereas in Germany I think that's been a positive, and there's a perception of our brand as associated with sort of English like country gardens, which there's like a sort of positive romantic perception of in Germany, you know, even like connections to like the royal family, royal wedding, tea parties, this sort of stuff has really been like on trend in Germany in a way that it hasn't in France. And I wish I could say it was deliberate, but it's something that we've sort of like learned over time. I think more latterly as well, in Germany, some of our embracing of sustainability and eco-credentials has been particularly important. Obviously, that's important everywhere, but Germany has really, you know, led Europe in terms of, you know, embracing use of recycling and other, you know, eco-impact concerns much before it became something that people cared about as much in the UK and other countries. And so having this lower impact product, maybe slightly less expensive product for a similar bouquet of flowers, but then like a craft, a DIY element, which is also a really popular trend in Germany, has really resonated well. The cultural resonance of the proposition does differ between countries, and I think that's really important.
Yeah, it makes lots of sense. And I guess for you as a CEO, super interesting to learn that, right? As in, almost crazy to think about the cultural impact that even Netflix shows can have on whole countries, and how that might actually change the perception of your entire brand and whether or not it should enter a market.
Yeah, look, I think when we started, we thought that maybe what we had developed in the UK would be more applicable across countries. And actually, it's turned out to be more nuanced. And while many aspects of it are applicable, not everything is applicable. So the supply chain and the technology platform digital experience are heavily applicable. The way that we work with delivery partners is reasonably applicable, but there are nuances in France. Delivery people use like parcel shops much more, like buildings have door codes. People tend to live in flats much more, especially in urban areas. So there are considerations like that. But then from a sort of like brand and consumer proposition and how people interact with our category, even what sorts of products they buy within it, how much they spend, for what occasions, things are really different. And understanding that and trying to find a way of maintaining the similarities and accepting the complexity of the differences between countries without it becoming unmanageable has been something that we've really been grappling with over the last couple of years. I think we started to get a handle on, and hence the confidence that we can develop it over other countries.
Next, we're talking about Aaron's biggest challenge as a founder and why I suddenly found myself getting an earful about wilted flowers from a disgruntled Heights customer. Find out after this quick break.
I know some of you have experienced the pain of setting up and managing your business's finances. You want to be moving the needle for your company, but instead you're on the phone to your bank trying to do stuff like send a large payment which has been blocked. This is why we're so happy to be working with Revolut for Business. Their business account lets you manage your company's finances and have full visibility on all outgoings. With Revolut Business, you can send and receive money in over 150 currencies at the interbank rate and even set up multi-currency accounts. But what I like the most is that you can integrate with all your apps or plugins like accounting and expenses and manage your finances easily from one place so you can focus on your actual business goals. We've partnered with Revolut Business to bring you guys an exclusive 2-month paid plan for free, which you can't find anywhere else. Go to revolut.com/secretleaders to claim your free 2-month trial. That's revolut.com/secretleaders. If you love flowers through your letterbox, you'll love getting environmentally friendly, sustainable supplements that take care of your brain from Heights right through your letterbox too. 2 capsules a day, full of the natural nutrients your brain needs to thrive, meant that 60 pills in the bottle wouldn't fit through a letterbox. So we redesigned the entire packaging experience for our customers, and we've won multiple packaging awards for our design and eye-catching solution. Why not check out why we've been called the most beautiful supplement in the world by Vogue? It's as good on your eyes as it is on your brain. Head to yourheights.com/leaders and use the code LEADERS for £10 off a quarterly subscription.
What would you say has been your toughest challenge as a CEO in your whole journey at Bloom & Wild?
There are a few ways of thinking about this. At the very beginning, there were lots of moments that where I just thought that perhaps the whole thing might not work. I remember, for example, learning that Royal Mail only accepted boxes that were 60 centimetres long, and we ordered boxes, and then I took them literally to the post office, and the chap behind the counter at the post office got out a tape measure and told me that the box was 61 centimetres long and therefore he couldn't accept it. My heart sunk, into the like centre of the earth at that point, and, since like redesigned our boxes so that they're unambiguously the right size and things like that. But there have been lots of moments like that where we didn't have ventilation in our boxes and therefore like the flowers got mouldy, and we made a ton of mistakes early on. I think, as we've grown to like scale up phase, a lot of the biggest challenges have been around like navigating, protecting, nurturing and maintaining our culture. And especially in the, having worked from home for, almost a year now, and onboarded about a third of our team during that process, this has been super important to get right. Our culture is so precious and valuable to us, but so much of it has developed through people's relationships with each other and, enjoying spending time together. And, everyone has screen fatigue. And so it's just much harder to navigate that. And I think we've done a good job of it, and we've tried to adapt how we do it. But I feel like ultimately, I need to be the custodian of that culture, and I need to continue to do so as we scale.
And what about you as a CEO personally? What are you really good at and what are you really bad at? And what would you say to the third part of that? Have you been developing best at? So going from quite bad to on the path to becoming better?
I think what I'm good at is kindness. It's super important for me to be kind to everybody that I interact with. I think it connects to like my desire to please people. I think it's really innate in the business that we're in, that you have to do it kindly. And I think I've tried to be kind to our consumers and those that we work with and to our team. And obviously I don't get like 100% positive feedback on that, but I think people recognize that I try and that it matters to me. And I think that's something that I'll, maybe it means I don't like strike the hardest commercial bargain and I like leave something on the table in a negotiation or whatever, but I'm actually okay with that. And I think the scope to like share in success rather than like hoard it. And so like, that's fine. I think, you know, the other thing I'd say, which kind of connects all of your questions, I'm both good at this and bad at this and like learning on it, is that I'm very detail oriented and I do think bottom up. I notice specifics rather than like patterns or themes. And then I like make lists of specific things and then I find how they connect together. And it's just how my mind works. And I've tried to be less like that and make my lists at like a less granular level of detail. I think people can feel that this means that I'm like micro-involved in their work. Sometimes I am micro-involved in their work because I do notice things and because I have an obsession with getting stuff right for our customers. And in a way, I think that's a good thing. In a way, I've also learned that sometimes I should be like less quick to give feedback and maybe somebody else will notice it first. And I don't need to always be the first person to say something, or I can think about whether there's a process that could have like worked differently rather than like, you know, commenting on the specific thing and stuff like that. So that's been my learning journey. It's also been around like hiring people. And I think as I've, been fortunate to like raise money and therefore build a stronger team around me, I've had a greater degree of trust in those around me. And therefore I felt less of a need for involvement in some of these areas. And that's something that I'm going to continue to do going forward. I'm also like trying to juggle more things and more stressed. And my wife encourages me to think about which of the balls I'm juggling are made of rubber and which ones are made of glass, and to just focus on the glass ones. It's obviously, she didn't come up with that analogy, but it's something that I think of regularly when I have like 2 minutes between meetings and there are like 40 unread Slack channels, and I like figure out which ones to read and which ones to
let bounce.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. What would you say is the most difficult bit of feedback that you've received? So you've shared like, you know, what you're working on, what's good, what's bad, but what's been really uncomfortable for you to hear and what did you learn from it?
I think what I find most difficult to hear, and I hear this from customers probably every few months or so, like I get an email or, I still do like customer phone calls and like customer delight inbox replies. And I get something along the lines of the way that you are trying to sell your product doesn't work and your company should not exist. And there's often in these situations, there's no amount of persuading you can do. And like if you sort of try and argue, then like I don't want to become like unempathetic or sort of come across like I'm not listening to the customer. But on the other hand, like I think our company should exist, and I've spent 8 years of my life building it to be like the best company I possibly can. And I would never, I think the related feedback is, you set out to try and ruin my like mum's birthday or whatever it is. And like, I would, there isn't a like a bone in my body that would try to ruin anything for anybody like this. It's sort of so far from my DNA. And to sort of hear that not only has that happened, which I'm like mortified about, but that people think I'm trying to do it deliberately, or that I've like constructed a company that like shouldn't exist, which because like flowers can't possibly be sent this way, is something that I find difficult to process on a lot of levels, because it's just so different to both my own personal DNA and to what I'm trying to achieve as a business and get my team to achieve. So I find that hard to hear, but luckily we don't hear it as much. And often we're able to turn it around, and sometimes people want to be heard, and sometimes you have to pick up the phone and it's time consuming and you're busy as a CEO, but they want to hear from you, not from somebody else. But I remember some of those conversations, and often those people turn out to be like long-term advocates, you know, and I always learn from those calls.
I've got a very funny anecdote for you, which it's literally just come up and it's so relevant, but it sounds like it's crapping on one of your competitors, which is absolutely not what I'm doing, but this is the verbatim conversation that happened, which is we had a customer basically get frustrated that we took a payment from them. They're on an annual subscription and it renewed and they hadn't read the emails, basically like warning them, letting them know, but regardless, they hadn't seen it. It came out of their account and then they were like furious on customer service, going mad at us. So I called him and basically it took him about 2 minutes before, and like on a tirade, and started describing things to me. And I'm like, this does not sound quite right. Basically, he thought I was the CEO of Freddy's Flowers because he'd also complained to them that day. He was going ballistic at me about his flower delivery. So we had one of those really funny conversations where for like 2 minutes, you'll kind of both think that you're talking about the same thing, but you're actually not. And I had to like let him know that I was actually from Heights and it was a different complaint that he'd had. So it was actually quite funny. It was actually a really good way to diffuse the conversation because he was like very happy to have this sort of silliness of the situation. So that was fortunate. But yeah, it does happen, as you know, like you have these conversations with customers and, you know, sometimes there's no making them happy. Sometimes it is literally the call that will make them happy. And then if you're lucky, there'll be these silly moments that you can both laugh at.
We actually occasionally get these where people complain about a bouquet and it isn't our bouquet. And we're 100% sure that it's not our bouquet or like our greeting card or like our printer system or whatever. And customers will just insist that we've sold them this bouquet and they want a refund from us. And that, you know, they don't accept that it's not our product. There's no record of them in the system. And yeah, that can be a little bit of a sort of like impasse to navigate. And often we try and like find it on a competitor's website to prove to them that it's somebody else, not ours. So we've been there too.
Right. So starting to wrap up now, I'd love to know, you know, you've walked into these meetings, you've raised £75 million, so $100 million+. There's obviously a story there about just how big a flower company can be. So what is that story? How big can you be? And where do you say, yep, fulfilled that mission?
Yeah, we'll never fulfill our mission because we'll never have 100% market share. But we'll
correct answer.
The flower category globally is worth around £50 billion. Yeah, that represents over 1 billion flower transactions every year, and you know we're doing a few million of those. So we've made meaningful headway, but there's a huge way to go around the world. The flower category is just one of a few categories that we can play in. We can play in plants, we can play in home accessories, we can play in gifting more broadly. The global market for gifting, of which flowers is a couple of percent, is like several hundreds of billions of dollars. So not all of this is immediately accessible right now. But if you think about, can we sell other products? Can we sell them in other countries? Can we sell them in other ways? We've recently, for example, started selling flowers in Sainsbury's, which we're really proud of. And I think we've brought our levels of innovation and product differentiation into a physical store environment. All of that really you know, really adds up to being able to build a business that's exciting for investors and they can see, you know, being worth like astronomical sums in the future.
Fair enough. Does the problem of sending and receiving flowers still excite you like it did originally?
Even more so, because I feel like we can actually crack it now. To start with, you know, as like a guy with a £3,000 website handing out flowers one at a time outside a tube station. And, you know, I didn't really have any right to succeed. I feel now I've been able to amass a team of people and build like capabilities and differentiation that people at scale really care about and really value. And you know, yet the vast majority of people in the world have never experienced Bloom and Wild, and we also have so many ways that we can still make it better. So I feel like, you know, rather than it being a problem that we might be able to succeed at, I think it's a problem that we can succeed at, and we just need to carry on doing so and continue getting better. So I think different founders enjoy different stages to different amounts. And personally, I love this stage, you know, a lot more than trying to do everything myself badly in the first year and on the cheap.
Very fair. What is the best piece of advice that you've ever been given on your journey and by who?
I was introduced by my best friend to my co-founder, Ben, and he really pushed me to get going with starting a company, and you know, I had all sorts of hesitations about maybe this wasn't the right company, and maybe I should do something different, and maybe it wasn't going to work, and you know, I had a good job and whatever. And he basically persuaded me that nobody regrets trying, and that, you know, the sort of safety net of my job that I had before would still be there. And I needed that push because I was sort of going from something that I was doing well at, and you know, and I was comfortable at, to something that I didn't have any skills at, and actually I had even fewer skills than I thought I did at, because I thought that I had these transferable skills from being a management consultant. Actually, you know, other than like, you know, knowing how to make like some slides to pitch an investor or like build a model, you don't really like have any like applicable skills for starting a company from that sort of path. And they've become more relevant now as we've started to scale, but I needed that encouragement to do something that in hindsight I'm so glad I've like spent this period of my life doing, and I'm going to spend the next period of my life continuing to do.
Next week on Secret Leaders.
We have an amazing team, we have great revenue, we've got incredibly exciting product development, we've got phenomenal tech that we're developing in personalization, and I want to be leading in personalization in beauty around the world in how we look at personalization, because I think personalization, the way some people have done it, is so bloody impersonal. And personalization is what should bring trust to a brand and a community and a conversion.
Next week, we've got an awesome conversation with Trini Woodall, the founder of the incredibly successful Trini London, and of course of TV fame from Trini and Susanna. And she opens up about just about everything in one of my favorite conversations in ages. So tune in or you'll miss out. If you're enjoying our show and you're happy to help us, please can you get out your phone right now and rate us on your favorite podcast player, because that's the stuff that actually makes a difference. Thanks so much. This episode was hosted by me, Dan Murray-Serta. It was produced by Rich Martel, with editing done by Lower Street Media.